strangers go to battle against our ancient foe, the one accursed above all others. The fate of the world hangs upon their quest, and your aid is needed. But do I care about the world?
Rogue's voice was filled with contempt.
But what do I care about maimed Torek? I am safe within the hand of Ul. He has need of me here, and I will not go from the holy caverns to risk defilement in the lewd company of unbelievers and monsters.
The entire world will be defiled if Torek gains dominion over it, Belgareth pointed out. And if we fail, Torek will become king of the world.
He will not reign in Ulgo, Rogue retorted.
How little you know him, Palgara murmured.
I will not leave the caves, Rogue insisted. The coming of the child is at hand, and I have been chosen to reveal him to the Ulgo, and to guide and instruct him until he is ready to become Gorim. How interesting, the Gorim observed dryly. Just who was it who advised you of this election? Ul spoke to me, Rogue declared. Odd. The caverns respond universally to the voice of Ul. All Ulgo would have heard his voice.
He spoke to me in my heart,
Rogue replied quickly.
What a curious thing for him to do,
the Gorim answered mildly.
All of this is beside the point, Belgareth said brusquely. I would prefer to have you join us willingly, Rogue. But, willing or not, you will join us. A power greater than any of us commands it. You can argue and resist as much as you like. But when we leave here, you will be going with us.
Rogue spat.
Never. I will remain here in the service of Ul and of the child, who will become Gorim of Ulgo. And if you try to compel me, my followers will not permit it.
Why do we need this blind mole, Belgareth? Barak wanted to know. It's just going to be an aggravation to us. I have noticed that men who spend all of their time congratulating themselves on their sanctity tend to be very poor companions. And what can this one do that I cannot?
Rogue looked at the red-bearded giant with disdain.
Big men with big mouths seldom have big brains. Watch closely, hairy one.
He walked over to the sloping wall of the chamber.
Can you do this?
He asked, and slowly pushed his hand directly into the rock, as if he were sinking into water. Silk whistled with amazement, and moved quickly over to the wall beside the fanatic. As Relg pulled his hand out of the rock, Silk reached out to put his own hand on the precise spot.
How did you do that?
He demanded, shoving at the stones. Relg laughed harshly and turned his back.
That's the ability that makes him useful to us, Silk, Belgareth explained. Relg is a diviner. He finds caves, and we need to locate the caves under Rakhtol. If necessary, Relg can walk through solid rock to find them for us.
How could anyone do that?
Silk asked, still staring at the spot where Relg had sunk his hand into the wall.
It has to do with the nature of matter, the sorcerer replied. What we see as solid isn't really all that impenetrable.
Either something is solid or it is not, Silk insisted, his face baffled.
Solidity is an illusion, Belgareth told him. Rogue can slip the bits and pieces that make up his substance through the spaces that exist between the bits and pieces that make up the substance of the rock.
Can you do it?
Silk demanded skeptically.
Belgareth shrugged. I don't know. I have never had occasion to try. Anyway, Rogue can smell caves, and he goes straight to them. He probably doesn't know himself how he does it.
I am led by my sanctity, Rogue declared arrogantly.
Perhaps that's it,
the sorcerer agreed with a tolerant smile.
The holiness of the caves draws me, since I'm drawn to all holy things, Relg rasped on. And for me to leave the caverns of Ulgo would be to turn my back on holiness and move toward defilement.
Well, we will see, Belgareth told him.
The glow in the rock wall, which Tenedra had noticed before, began to shimmer and pulsate, and the princess seemed to see a dim shape within the rocks. Then, as if the stones were only air, the shape became distinct and stepped out into the chamber. For just a moment, it seemed that the figure was an old man, bearded and robed like the Gorum, although much more robust. Then Zenedra was struck by an overpowering sense of something more than human. With an odd shudder, she realized that she was in the presence of divinity. Relg gaped at the bearded figure, and he began to tremble violently. With a strangled cry, he prostrated himself. The figure looked calmly at the groveling zealot.
"Rise, Relg,"
it said in a soft voice that seemed to carry all of the echoes of eternity in it, and the caverns outside rang with the sound of that voice.
"Rise, Relg, and serve thy god."
Chapter 18. Tenedra had received an exquisite education. She had been so thoroughly trained that she knew instinctively all of the niceties of etiquette and all of the proper forms to be observed upon coming into the presence of an emperor or a king. But the physical presence of a god still baffled and even frightened her. She felt awkward, even gauche, like some ignorant farm girl. She found herself trembling, and, for one of the few times in her life, she hadn't the faintest idea of what to do. Ul was still looking directly into Relg's awestruck face.
"Thy mind has twisted what I told thee, my son," the god said gravely. "Thou hast turned my words to make them conform to thy desires, rather than to my will."
Relg flinched, and his eyes were stricken.
"I told thee that the child who will be Gorum will come to Ulgo through thee, and that thou must prepare thyself to nurture him and see to his rearing. Did I tell thee to exalt thyself by reason of this?"
Relg began to shake violently.
"Did I tell thee to preach sedition? Or to stir Ulgo against the Gorum whom I have chosen to guide them?"
Relg collapsed.
"Forgive me, O my god," he begged, groveling again on the floor.
"Rise, Relg," Ul told him sternly. "I am not pleased with thee, and thine obeisance offends me, for thy heart is filled with pride. I will bend thee to my will, Relg, or I will break thee. I will purge thee of this overweening esteem thou hast for thyself. Only then wilt thou be worthy of the task to which I have set thee."
Relg stumbled to his feet, his face filled with remorse.
"Oh, mein God," he choked.
"Hearken unto my words, Relg, and obey me utterly. It is my command that thou accompany Belgarath, disciple of Aldur, and render unto him all aid within thy power. Thou wilt obey him, even as if he were speaking in my voice. Dost thou understand this?"
"Yes, O my god," Relg replied humbly.
"And wilt thou obey?"
"I will do as thou command me, O my god, though it cost me my life."
"It shall not cost thee thy life, Relg, for I have need of thee. Thy reward for this shall be beyond thine imagining."
Relg bowed in mute acceptance. Then the god turned toward Gorim.
"Abide yet a while, my son. Though the years press heavily upon thee, it shall not be long until thy burden shall be lifted. Know that I am pleased with thee.
The Gorum bowed in acceptance.
Belgarath, Ol greeted the sorcerer, I have watched thee at thy task, and I share thy master's pride in thee. The prophecy moves through thee and Balgara, thy daughter, toward that moment that we have all awaited.
Belgarath also bowed.
It's been a long time, most holy. And there were twists and turns to it that none of us could see at the beginning.
Truly, all agreed. It hath surprised us all upon occasion. Hath Alder's gift to the world come into his birthright as yet?
Not entirely, most holy,
Balgara answered gravely.
He has touched the edges of it, however. And what he has shown us, so far, has given us hope for his success.
Hail, then, Belgarion, Ol said to the startled young man. Take my blessing with thee, and know that I will join with Aldur to be with thee when thy great task begins.
Garion bowed, rather awkwardly, Sinedra noticed. She decided that soon, very soon, she would have to give him some schooling in these matters. Oh, he would resist, naturally. He was impossibly stubborn, but she knew that if she nagged and badgered him enough, he would eventually come around. And it was for his own good, after all. Ol seemed to be still looking at Garion, but there was a subtle difference in his expression. It seemed to Sinedra that he was communicating wordlessly to some other presence, something that was a part of Garion, and yet not a part of him. He nodded gravely then, and turned his gaze directly upon the princess herself.
She seems but a child, he observed to Pulgara.
She is of suitable age, most holy. She is a dryad, and they are all quite small.
Ol smiled gently at the princess, and she felt herself suddenly glowing in the warmth of his smile.
She is like a flower, is she not? She still has a few thorns, most holy, Belgarath replied, and a bit of a bramble in her nature.
We will value her all the more for that, Belgarath. The time will come when her fire and her brambles will serve our cause far more than her beauty.
Ol glanced once more at Garion, and a strange, knowing smile crossed his face. For some reason, Sinedra felt herself beginning to blush, then lifted her chin as if daring the blush to go any further.
It is to speak with thee that I have come, my daughter.
Ol said directly to her then, and his tone and face grew serious.
Thou must abide here when thy companions depart. Do not venture into the kingdom of the Murgos, for if it should come to pass that thou make this journey unto Rachtol, thou shalt surely die, and without thee the struggle against the darkness must fail. Abide here, in the safety of Ulgo, until thy companions return.
This was the kind of thing Sinedra completely understood. As a princess, she knew the need for instant submission to authority. Though she had wheedled, coaxed, and teased her father all of her life to get her own way, she had seldom directly rebelled. She bowed her head.
I will do as thou hast commanded, most holy,
she replied, without even thinking of the implication of the god's words. Ol nodded with satisfaction.
Thus is the prophecy protected. Each of you has his appointed tasks in this work of ours. And I have mine as well. I will delay you no longer, my children. Fare you all well in this. We will meet again.
Then he vanished. The sounds of his last words echoed in the caverns of Ulgo. After a moment of stunned silence, the hymn of adoration burst forth again in a mighty chorus, as every Ulgo raised his voice in ecstasy at this divine visitation.
Baylor, Barak breathed explosively. Did you feel it?
Ul has a commanding presence, Belgarath agreed.
He turned to look at Relg, one eyebrow cocked rather whimsically.
I take it that you have had a change of heart.
Relg's face had gone ashen, and he was still trembling violently.
I will obey my God.
Where he has commanded me, I will go.
I'm glad that's been settled, Belgarath told him. At the moment, he wants you to go to Rachthol. He may have other plans for you later, but right now, Rachthol's enough to worry about.
I will obey you without question, the fanatic declared,
even as my God has commanded me.
Good, Belgarath replied, and then he went directly to the point. Is there a way to avoid the weather and the difficulties above?
I know a way, Relg answered. It is difficult and long, but it will lead us to the foothills above the land of the horse people.
You see, Silk observed to Barak, he's proving useful already.
Barak grunted, still not looking entirely convinced.
May I know why we must go to Rachthol?
Relg asked, his entire manner changed by his meeting with his god.
We have to reclaim the Orb of Aldor, Belgarath told him.
I have heard of it, Relg admitted.
Silk was frowning.
Are you sure that you will be able to find the caves under Rachthol?
He asked Relg.
Those caves won't be the caverns of Ul, you know.
In Chthal Murgos, they're not likely to be holy. Quite the opposite, most probably.
I can find a cave anywhere, Relg stated confidently.
All right, then, Belgarath continued. Assuming that all goes well, we will go up to the caves and into the city, unobserved. We'll find Tuchik and take the orb away from him.
Won't he try to fight? Durnik asked.
I certainly hope so, Belgarath replied fervently. Barak laughed shortly. You're starting to sound like an Elorn, Belgarath.
That is not necessarily a virtue, Polgara pointed out.
I'll deal with the magician of Rachthol when the time comes, the sorcerer said grimly. At any rate, once we have recovered the orb, we'll go back down through the caves and make a run for it.
We thought of Chthal Murgos hot on our heels, Silk added. I have had dealings occasionally with Murgos. They are a persistent sort of people.
That could be a problem, Belgarath admitted. We don't want their pursuit gaining too much momentum. If an army of Murgos inadvertently follows us into the west, it will be viewed as an invasion. That would start a war that we are not ready for yet. Any ideas?
He looked around.
Turn them all into frogs,
Barak suggested with a shrug. Belgarath gave him a withering look.
It was just a thought, Barak said defensively.
Why not just stay in caves under the city until they give up the search, then?
Durnik offered. Polgara shook her head firmly. No. There is a place we have to be at a certain time. We will barely make it there as it is. We cannot afford to lose a month or more hiding in some cave in Chthal Murgos.
Where do we have to be, Aunt Paul?
Garion asked.
I'll explain it later,
she evaded, throwing a quick glance at Tenedra. The princess perceived immediately that the appointment the lady spoke of concerned her, and curiosity began to gnaw at her. Mandorallan, his face thoughtful and his fingers lightly touching the ribs that had been cracked in his encounter with Grull, cleared his throat.
Does there, perchance, happen to be a map of the region we must enter somewhere nearby, Holy Gorum?
The Gorum thought for a moment.
I believe I have one somewhere.
He tapped his cup lightly on the table, and an Ulgo serving man immediately entered the chamber. The Gorham spoke briefly to him, and the serving man went out.
"The map that I recall is very old," the Gorham told Mandarallan, "and I'm afraid it won't be very accurate. Our cartographers have a difficulty comprehending the distances involved in the world above."
"The distances do not matter so much," Mandarallan assured him. "I wish but to refresh my memory concerning the contiguity of certain other realms upon the borders of Ktal Morgos. I was at best an indifferent student of geography as a schoolboy."
The serving man returned and handed a large roll of parchment to the Gorham. The Gorham, in turn, passed the roll to Mandarallan. The knight carefully unrolled the chart and studied it for a moment.
"It is as I recalled."
He turned to Belgarath.
"Thou hast said, ancient friend, that no Murgo will enter the Vale of Aldor?"
"That's right."
Mandarallan pointed at the map.
"The closest border from Rachtol is that which abuts Tolnedra. Logic would seem to dictate that our route of escape should lie in that direction, toward the nearest frontier."
"All right," Belgarath conceded.
"Let us then seem to make all haste toward Tolnedra, leaving behind us abundant evidence of our passage. Then at some point where rocky ground would conceal signs of our change of direction, let us turn and strike out to the northwest, toward the Vale. Might this not confound them? May we not confidently anticipate that they will continue to pursue our imagined course? In time, certainly, they will realize their error, but by then we will be many leagues ahead of them. Pursuing far to our rear, might not the further discouragement of the prohibited Vale cause them to abandon the chase entirely?"
They all looked at the map.
"I like it," Barak said, effusively slapping one huge hand on the knight's shoulder.
Mandarallan winced and put his hand to his injured ribs.
"Sorry, Mandarallan. I forgot," Barak apologized quickly.
Silk was studying the map intently. "It has got a lot to recommend it, Belgarath. And if we angle up to here," he pointed, "we will come out on top of the eastern escarpment. We should have plenty of time to make the descent, but they'll definitely want to think twice before trying it. It's a good mile straight down at that point."
"We could send word to Quahag,"
Hetar suggested.
"If a few clans just happened to be gathered at the foot of the escarpment there, the Mogos would think more than twice before starting down."
Belgarath scratched at his beard.
"All right," he decided after a moment. "We'll try it that way. As soon as Relg leads us out of Ulgo, you go pay your father a visit, Hetar. Tell him what we are going to do and invite him to bring a few thousand warriors down to the Vale to meet us."
The lean Algar nodded, his black scalp lock bobbing. His face, however, showed a certain disappointment.
"Forget it, Hetar," the old man told him bluntly. "I never had any intention of taking you into Tol Morgos. There would be too many opportunities there for you to get yourself in trouble."
Hetar sighed somewhat mournfully.
"Don't take it so hard, Hetar. Morgos are a fanatic race," Silk bantered. "You can be practically certain that a few of them, at least, will try the descent, no matter what's waiting for them at the bottom. You'd almost have to make an example of them, then, wouldn't you?"
Hetar's face brightened at the thought.
"Silk,"
Lady Polgara said reprovingly. The little man turned an innocent face toward her.
"We have to discourage pursuit, Polgara." "Yes, of course," she replied sarcastically. "It wouldn't do to have Murgos infesting the Vale now, would it? Do you mind? Oh, I'm not really all that bloodthirsty, you know."
She turned her back on him. Silk sighed piously.
"Ah, she always thinks the worst of me."
By now, Senedra had sufficient time to consider the implications of the promise she had so unhesitatingly given to Ull. The others would soon leave, and she must remain behind. Already she was beginning to feel isolated, cut off from them. As they made plans which did not include her, the more she thought about it, the worse it became. She felt her lower lip beginning to quiver. The Gorum of the Ulgos had been watching her, his wise old face sympathetic.
"It is difficult to be left behind," he said gently,
almost as if his large eyes had been seeing directly into her thoughts.
"And our caves are strange to you, dark and seemingly filled with gloom."
Wordlessly, she nodded her agreement.
"In a day or so, however, your eyes will become accustomed to the subdued light. There are beauties here which no one from the outside has ever seen. While it's true that we have no flowers, there are hidden caverns where gems bloom on the floors and walls like wild blossoms. No trees or foliage grow in our sunless world, but I know a cave wall where vines of pure gold twist in coils down from the ceiling and spill out across the floor."
"Careful, Holy Grolum," Silk warned. "The princess is Tonedrin. If you show her that kind of wealth, she may go into hysterics right before your eyes."
"I don't find that particularly amusing, Prince Keldar," Tenedra told him in a frosty tone.
"I am overcome with remorse, Your Imperial Highness," he apologized with towering hypocrisy and a florid bow.
In spite of herself, the princess laughed. The rat-faced little Drasnian was so absolutely outrageous that she found it impossible to remain angry with him.
"You will be as my beloved granddaughter while you stay in Ulgo, princess. We can walk together beside the silent lakes and explore the long-forgotten caves. And we can talk. The world outside knows little of Ulgo. It may well be that you will become the very first stranger to understand us."
Tenedra impulsively reached out to take his frail old hand in hers. He was such a dear old man.
"I will be honored, Holy Gorum," she told him with complete sincerity.
They stayed that night in comfortable quarters in the Gorum's pyramid-shaped house, though the terms night and day had no meaning in this strange land beneath the earth. The following morning, several Ulgols led the horses into the Gorum's cavern, traveling, the princess assumed, by some longer route than the one the party had followed, and her friends made their preparations to leave. Tenedra sat to one side, feeling terribly alone. Her eyes moved from face to face as she tried to fix each of them in her memory. When she came at last to Geryon, her eyes brimmed. Irrationally, she had already begun to worry about him. He was so impulsive. She knew that he'd do things that would put him in danger once he was out of her sight. To be sure, Palgara would be there to watch over him, but it wasn't the same. She felt quite suddenly angry with him for all of those foolish things he was going to do, and for the worry his careless behavior was going to cause her. She glared at him, wishing that he would do something for which she could scold him. She had determined that she would not follow them out of the Gorum's house, that she would not stand forlornly at the edge of the waters staring after them as they departed. But as they all filed out through the heavy arched doorway, her resolution crumbled. Without thinking, she ran after Geryon and caught his arm. He turned with surprise, and she stretched up on her tiptoes, took his face between her tiny hands, and kissed him.
"You must be careful," she commanded.
Then she kissed him again, spun and ran sobbing back into the house, leaving him staring after her in baffled astonishment.
Part 4. Cathal Murgos.
Chapter 19. They had been in the darkness for days. The single dim light Relg carried could only provide a point of reference, something to follow. The darkness pressed against Geryon's face, and he stumbled along the uneven floor with one hand thrust out in front of him to keep himself from banging his head into unseen rocks. It was not only the musty-smelling darkness, however. He could sense the oppressive weight of the mountains above him and on all sides. The stone seemed to push in on him, as he was closed in, sealed up in miles of solid rock. He fought continually with the faint, fluttering edges of panic, and he often clenched his teeth to keep from screaming. There seemed to be no purpose to the twisting, turning route Relg followed. At the branching of passageways, his choices seemed random. But always he moved with steady confidence through the dark, murmuring caves where the memory of sounds whispered in the dank air, voices out of the past echoing endlessly, whispering, whispering. Relg's air of confidence as he led them was the only thing that kept Geryon from giving in to unreasoning panic. At one point the zealot stopped. "What is wrong?" Silk asked sharply, his voice carrying that same faint edge of panic that Geryon felt gnawing at his own awareness.
"I have to cover my eyes here," Relg replied.
He was wearing a peculiarly fashioned shirt of leaf mail, a strange garment formed of overlapping metal scales, belted at the waist and with a snug-fitting hood that left only his face exposed. From his belt hung a heavy, hook-pointed knife, a weapon that made Geryon cold just to look at it. He drew a piece of cloth out from under his mail shirt and carefully tied it over his face.
"And now why are you doing that?" Durnick asked him.
"There's a vein of quartz in the cavern just ahead," Relg told him.
"It reflects sunlight down from the outside.
The light is very bright."
"How can you tell which way to go if you are blindfolded?" Silk protested.
"The cloth is not that thick. I can see through it well enough. Let's go."
They rounded a corner in the gallery, and Geryon saw light ahead. He resisted an impulse to run toward it. They moved on, the hooves of the horses Hedhar was leading clattering on the stone floor. The lighted cavern was huge, and it was filled with a glittering crystal light. A gleaming band of quartz angled across the ceiling, illuminating the cavern with a blazing radiance. Great points of stone hung like icicles from the ceiling, and other points rose from the floor to meet them. In the center of the cavern, another underground lake stretched. Its surface rippled by a tiny waterfall trickling down into the upper end with an endless tinkling sound that echoed in the cave like a little silver bell, and joined harmoniously with the faint, remembered sigh of the singing of the Ulgos miles behind. Geryon's eyes were dazzled by color that seemed to be everywhere. The prisms in the crystalline quartz twisted the light, breaking it into colored fragments and filling the cave with a multi-hued light of the rainbow. Geryon found himself quite suddenly wishing that he could show the dazzling cave to Tenedra, and the thought puzzled him.
"Hurry,"
Relg urged them, holding one hand across his brow as if to further shade his already veiled eyes.
"Why not stop here?" Barak suggested. "We need some rest, and this looks like a good place."
"It is the worst place in all of these caves," Relg told him.
"Hurry." "Maybe you like the dark, but the rest of us aren't that fond of it."
He looked round the cave.
"Protect your eyes, you fool," Relg snapped.
"I don't care for your tone, friend."
"You'll be blind once we get past this place, if you don't. It has taken your eyes 2 days to get used to this dark. You'll lose all of that if you stay here too long."
Barak stared hard at the Ulgo for a moment. Then he grunted and nodded shortly.
"I'm sorry. I didn't understand."
He reached out to put his hand on Relg's shoulder in apology.
"Don't touch me,"
Relg cried, shrinking away from the big hand.
"What's the matter?"
"Just don't touch me. Not ever."
Relg hurried on ahead.
And what is the matter with him?
Barak demanded.
He doesn't want you to defile him,
Belgarath explained.
Defile him? Defile him?
He is very concerned about his personal purity. The way he sees it, Barak, any kind of touch could soil him.
Soil? He's as dirty as a pig in a wallow already.
It's a different kind of dirt. Come, let's move on.
Barak strode along behind the rest of them, grumbling and sputtering in outrage. They moved into another dark passageway, and Geryon looked longingly back over his shoulder at the fading light from the glowing cavern behind. Then they rounded a corner, and the light was gone. There was no way to keep track of time in the murmuring darkness. They stumbled on, pausing now and then to eat or to rest, though Geryon's sleep was filled with nightmares about mountains crushing in on him. He had almost given up all hope of ever seeing the sky again when the first faint cobweb touch of moving air brushed his cheek. It had been, as closely as he could judge, 5 days since they had left the last dimly lighted gallery of the Ulgos behind and plunged into this eternal night. At first he thought the faint hint of warmer air might only be his imagination, but then he caught the scent of trees and grass and the musty air of the cave, and he knew that somewhere ahead there lay an opening, a way out. The touch of warmer air outside grew stronger, and the smell of grass began to fill the passageway along which they crept. The floor began to slope upward, and, imperceptibly at first, it grew less dark. It seemed somehow that they moved up out of the endless night toward the light of the first morning in the history of the world. The horses, plodding along at the rear, had also caught the scent of fresh air, and their pace quickened. Relg, however, moved slower, and then slower still. Finally, he stopped altogether. The faint metallic rustling of his leaf mail shirt spoke loudly for him. Relg was trembling, bracing himself for what lay ahead. He bound his veil across his face again, mumbling something over and over in the snarling language of the Ulgos, fervent, almost pleading. Once his eyes were covered, he moved on again, reluctantly, his feet almost dragging. Then there was golden light ahead. The mouth of the passageway was a jagged, irregular opening with a stiff tangle of limbs sharply outlined in front of it. With a sudden clatter of little hooves, the colt, ignoring Hetar's sharp command, bolted toward the opening and plunged out into the light. Belgarath scratched at his whiskers, squinting after the little animal.
"Maybe you had better take him and his mother with you when we separate," he said to Hetar. "He seems to have a little trouble taking things seriously, and Cthulhu Murgos is a very serious place."
Hetar nodded gravely.
"I can't,"
Relg blurted, turning his back to the light and pressing himself against the rock wall of the passageway.
"I can't do it."
"Of course you can,"
Aunt Paul said comfortingly to him.
"We will go out slowly, so you can get used to it a little at a time."
"Do not touch me,"
Relg replied almost absently.
"That is going to get very tiresome," Barak growled.
Geryon and the rest of them pushed ahead eagerly, their hunger for the light pulling at them. They shoved their way roughly through the tangle of bushes at the mouth of the cave. Blinking and shading their eyes, they emerged into the sunlight. The light at first stabbed Geryon's eyes painfully, but after a few moments he found that he could see again. The partially concealed entrance to the caves was near the midpoint of a rocky hillside. Behind them, the snow-covered mountains of Ulgo glittered in the morning sun, outlined against the deep blue sky, and a vast plain spread before them like a sea. The tall grass was golden with autumn, and the morning breeze touched it into long, undulating waves. The plain reached to the horizon, and Geryon felt as if he had just awakened from a nightmare. Just inside the mouth of the cave, behind them, Relg knelt with his back to the light, praying and beating at his shoulders and chest with his fists.
"Now what is he doing?"
Barak demanded.
"It is a kind of purification ritual," Belgarath explained. "He is trying to purge himself of all unholiness and draw the essence of the caves into his soul. He thinks it may help to sustain him while he's on the outside."
"How long's he going to be at it?"
"About an hour, I'd imagine. It's a fairly complicated ritual."
Relg stopped praying long enough to bind a second veil across his face on top of the first one.
"If he wraps any more cloth around his head, he is likely to smother," Silk observed.
"I had better get started,"
Hetar said, tightening the straps on his saddle.
"Is there anything else that you wanted me to tell Kohach?"
"Tell him to pass the word along to the others about what has happened so far. Things are getting to the point where I would like everyone to be more or less alert."
Hetar nodded.
"Do you know where we are?"
Barak asked him.
"Of course."
The tall man looked out at the seemingly featureless plain before him.
"It is probably going to take us at least a month to get to Rakhtal and back. If we get a chance, we light signal fires on top of the eastern escarpment before we start down. Tell Hohag how important it is for him to be waiting for us. We do not want Murgos blundering into Algeria. I am not ready for a war just yet."
"We will be there,"
Hetar replied, swinging up into his saddle.
"Be careful in Khal Murgos."
He turned his horse and started down the hill toward the plain with the mare and the colt tagging along behind him. The colt stopped once to look back at Geryon, gave a forlorn little whinny, then turned to follow his mother. Barak shook his head somberly.
"I'm going to miss Hetar," he rumbled.
"Khal Murgos would not be a good place for Hetar," Silk pointed out. "We would have to put a leash on him."
"I know that," Barak sighed. "But I will miss him all the same."
"Which direction do we take?"
Mandarallan asked, squinting out at the grasslands. Belgarath pointed to the southeast.
"That way. We will cross the upper end of the vale to the escarpment, and then go through the southern tip of Mishrach Achthul. The Thuls don't put out patrols as regularly as the Murgos do."
"Thuls do not do much of anything, unless they have to," Silk noted. "They are too preoccupied with trying to avoid Grolums."
"When do we start?" Durnik asked.
"As soon as Relg finishes his prayers," Belgarath replied. "We'll have time for breakfast then," Barak said dryly.
They rode all of that day across the flat grassland of southern Algeria beneath the deep blue autumn sky. Relg, wearing an old hooded tunic of Durnik's over his mail shirt, rode badly, with his legs sticking out stiffly. He seemed to be concentrating more on keeping his face down than on watching where he was going.
Barak watched sourly, with disapproval written plainly on his face. "I'm not trying to tell you your business, Belgarath," he said after several hours. "But that one is going to be trouble before we are finished with this."
"The light hurts his eyes, Barak," Aunt Paul told the big man. "And he is not used to writing. Don't be so quick to criticize."
Barak clamped his mouth shut, his expression still disparaging.
"At least we'll be able to count on his staying sober,"
Aunt Paul observed primly,
"which is more than I can say about some members of this little group."
Barak coughed uncomfortably. They set up for the night on the treeless bank of a meandering stream. Once the sun had gone down, Relg seemed less apprehensive, though he made an obvious point of not looking directly at the driftwood fire. Then he looked up and saw the first stars in the evening sky. He gaped up at them in horror, his unveiled face breaking out in a glistening sweat. He covered his head with his arms and collapsed face down on the earth with a strangled cry.
"Relg!"
Geryon exclaimed, jumping to the stricken man's side and putting his hands on him without thinking about it.
"Don't touch me,"
Relg gasped automatically.
Don't be stupid. What's wrong? Are you sick?
The sky, Rolg croaked with despair. The sky, it terrifies me.
The sky?
Garion was baffled.
Well, what's wrong with the sky?
He looked up at the familiar stars.
There's no end to it,
Rolg groaned.
It goes up forever.
Quite suddenly, Garion understood. In the caves, he had been afraid, unreasoningly afraid, because he had been closed in. Out here, under the open sky, Relg suffered from the same kind of blind terror. Garion realized with a kind of shock that, quite probably, Relg had never been outside of the caves of Ulgo in his entire life.
"It's all right," he assured him comfortingly. "The sky cannot hurt you. It's just up there. Don't pay it any attention."
"I cannot bear it."
"Don't look at it."
"I still know it's there. All of that emptiness."
Garion looked helplessly toward Aunt Paul. She made a quick gesture that told him to keep talking.
"It's not empty," he floundered. "It's full of things, all kinds of things, really. Clouds, birds, sunlight, stars."
"What?"
Relg lifted his face up out of his hands.
"What are those?"
"Clouds? Well, everyone knows what..."
Garion stopped. Obviously, Relg did not know what clouds were. He had never seen a cloud in his entire life. Garion tried to rearrange his thoughts to take that into account. It was not going to be easy to explain. He took in a deep breath.
"All right, let's start with clouds, then."
It took a long time, and Garion was not really sure that Relg understood, or if he was simply clinging to the words to avoid thinking about the sky. After clouds, birds were a bit easier, although feathers were very hard to explain.
"Ul spoke to you?"
Relg interrupted Garion's description of wings.
"He called you Delgarion? Is that your name?"
"Well,"
Garion replied uncomfortably,
"not really. Actually, my name is Garion, but I think the other name is supposed to be mine, too. Sometime later, I believe. When I'm older."
"All knows of things,"
Relg declared.
"If he called you Belgarion, that's your true name. I will call you Belgarion."
"I really wish you wouldn't."
"My God rebuked me,"
Relg groaned, his voice sinking into a kind of sick self-loathing.
"I have failed him."
Garion could not quite follow that. Somehow, even in the midst of his panic, Relg had been suffering the horrors of a theological crisis. He sat on the ground with his face turned away from the fire, and his shoulders slumped in an attitude of absolute despair.
"I am unworthy,"
he said, his voice on the verge of a sob.
"When all spoke, in the silence of my heart, I felt that I had been exalted above all other men. But now I am lower than dirt."
In his anguish, he began to beat the sides of his head with his fists.
"Stop that,"
Garion said sharply.
"You'll hurt yourself. What is this all about?"
"Ul told me that I was to reveal the child to Ulgo. I took his words to mean that I had found special grace in his eyes."
"What child are you talking about?"
"The child. The new Gorum. It is Ul's way to guide and protect his people. When an old Gorum's work is done, Ul places a special mark upon the eyes of the child who is to succeed him. When Ul told me that I had been chosen to bring the child to Ulgo, I revealed his words to others. They revered me and asked me to speak to them in the words of Ul. I saw sin and corruption all around me, and I denounced it,
and the people listened to me. But the words were mine, not Ull's. In my pride I presumed to speak for Ull. I ignored my own sins to accuse the sins of others.
Ralg's voice was harsh, with fanatic self-accusation.
I am filth, an abomination, he declared. Ull should have raised his hand against me and destroyed me.
That's forbidden,
Geryon told him without thinking.
Who has the power to forbid anything to Ull?
I don't know. All I know is that unmaking is forbidden, even to the gods. It's the very first thing we learn.
Ralg looked up sharply, and Geryon knew instantly that he had made a dreadful mistake.
You know the secrets of the gods?
The fanatic demanded incredulously.
Well, the fact that they're gods doesn't have anything to do with it,
Geryon replied.
The rule applies to everybody.
Relg's eyes burned with a sudden hope. He drew himself up onto his knees and bowed forward until his face was in the dirt.
Forgive me my sins, he intoned.
What?
I have exalted myself when I was unworthy.
You made a mistake, that's all. Just don't do it anymore. Please get up, Ralg.
I am wicked and impure.
You?
I have had impure thoughts about women.
Geryon flushed with embarrassment.
We all have those kinds of thoughts once in a while,
he said with a nervous cough.
My thoughts are wicked. Wicked, Ralg groaned with guilt. I burn with them.
I'm sure that Ull understands. Please, get up, Ralg. You don't have to do this.
I have prayed with my mouth when my mind and heart were not in my prayers.
Ralg!
I have sought out the hidden caves for the joy of finding them, rather than to consecrate them to Ull. I have thus defiled the gift given me by my God.
Please, Ralg!
Ralg began to beat his head on the ground.
Once I found the cave, where the echoes of Ull's voice lingered. I did not reveal it to others, but kept the sound of Ull's voice for myself.
Geryon began to become alarmed. The fanatic Ralg was working himself into a frenzy.
Punish me, Belgarion, Ralg pleaded. Lay a hard penance on me for my iniquity.
Geryon's mind was very clear as he answered. He knew exactly what he had to say.
I can't do that, Ralg. I can't punish you, he said gravely, any more than I can forgive you. If you have done things you should not have, that's between you and Ull. If you think you need to be punished, you'll have to do it yourself. I can't. I won't.
Ralg lifted his stricken face out of the dirt and stared at Geryon. Then, with a strangled cry, he lurched to his feet and fled wailing into the darkness.
Geryon?
Aunt Paul's voice rang with that familiar note.
I didn't do anything,
he protested almost automatically.
What did you say to him?
Belgarath demanded.
He said that he had committed all kinds of sins,
Geryon explained.
He wanted me to punish him and forgive him.
So?
I couldn't do that, Grandfather.
What's so hard about it?
Geryon stared at him.
All you had to do was lie to him a little. That's so difficult.
Lie? About something like that?
Geryon was horrified at the thought.
I need him, Geryon, and he cannot function if he is incapacitated by some kind of religious hysteria. Use your head, boy.
I can't do it, Grandfather,
Geryon repeated stubbornly.
It's too important to him for me to cheat him about it. You had better go and find him, Father,
Aunt Paul said.
Belgarath scowled at Geryon. You and I are not finished with this yet,
boy, he said, pointing a angry finger. Then, muttering irritably to himself, he went in search of Relg. With a cold certainty, Geryon suddenly knew that the journey to Chthol Murgos was going to be very long and uncomfortable. Chapter 20. Though summer that year had lingered in the lowlands and on the plains of Algeria, autumn was brief. The blizzards and squalls they had encountered in the mountains above Meragor, and again above the peaks of Urgo, had hinted that winter would be early and severe, and there was already a chill to the knights as they rode day after day across the open grassland toward the eastern escarpment. Belgarath had recovered from his momentary fit of anger over Geryon's failure to deal with Relg's attack of guilt, but then, with inescapable logic, he had placed an enormous burden squarely on Geryon's shoulders.
"For some reason he trusts you," the old man observed. "So I'm going to leave him entirely in your hands. I don't care what you have to do, but keep him from flying apart again."
At first, Relg refused to respond to Geryon's efforts to draw him out. But after a while, one of the waves of panic caused by the thought of the open sky above swept over the zealot, and he began to talk, haltingly at first, but then finally in a great rush. As Geryon had feared, Relg's favorite topic was sin. Geryon was amazed at the simple things that Relg considered sinful. Forgetting to pray before a meal, for example, was a major transgression. As the fanatic's gloomy catalogue of his faults expanded, Geryon began to perceive that most of his sins were sins of thought rather than of action. The one matter that kept cropping up again and again was the question of lustful thoughts about women. To Geryon's intense discomfort, Relg insisted on describing these lustful thoughts extensively.
"Women? They're not the same as we are, of course," the zealot confided one afternoon as they rode together. "Their minds and hearts are not drawn to holiness the way ours are. And they set out deliberately to tempt us with their bodies and draw us into sin."
"Why do you suppose that is?"
Geryon asked carefully.
"Their hearts are filled with lust," Relg declared. "They take particular delight in tempting the righteous. I tell you truly, Belgarion, you would not believe the subtlety of the creatures. I have seen the evidence of the wickedness in the soberest of matrons. The wives of some of my most devout followers, they are forever touching, brushing, as if by accident. They take great pains to allow the sleeves of their robes to slip up brazenly to expose their rounded arms. And the hems of their garments always seem to be hitching up to display their ankles."
"What if it bothers you? Don't look," Geryon suggested.
Relg ignored that.
"I have even considered banning them from my presence, but then I thought that it might be better if I kept my eyes on them, so that I could protect my followers from their wickedness. I thought for a time that I should forbid marriage among my followers. But some of the older ones told me that I might lose the young if I did that. I still think it might not be a bad idea."
"Wouldn't that sort of eliminate your followers altogether?"
Geryon asked him.
"I mean, if you kept it up long enough. No marriage, no children. You get my point?"
"That's the part I haven't worked out yet," Relg admitted.
"And what about the child? The new Gorim? If two people are supposed to get married so they can have a child, that particular special child, and you persuade them not to, aren't you interfering with something that Ul wants to happen?"
Relg drew in a sharp breath, as if he had not considered that, and then he groaned.
You see,